Welcome to the Engaged Midwife Podcast. This is Kara.
And I'm Missy.
And we're back again for another episode. I'm kind of excited about this topic, although it's not so fun to have it.
It's a good topic, I think, when we think about how we talk to patients and how we counsel them and what the implications are for pregnancy.
So today we're going to talk about gestational diabetes and screening and diagnosis. Maybe a brief little bit about management, but mostly we're going to be talking about screening and diagnosis.
Yeah, so it won't be a long conversation, but this is just one really important component of second trimester care.
It is really important. And I think that particularly as someone that takes care of populations that are at risk and just it's really widespread in my community. So I think that it's good for us to talk about this because I definitely encounter it for all patients when we're talking about screening, but definitely more with diagnosis and management as well.
So what do you want to start with?
Well, I think it's important to understand why we check for it first. And that is because pregnancy in and of itself is an insulin resistant state. And so it is not out of the realm of understanding to think, oh, that makes a connection with some people are going to struggle with that even more. And that insulin resistance will develop into a type of diabetes that occurs in pregnancy.
Yeah, 7% of women, around 7%, end up with gestational diabetes in pregnancy. So, I mean, it's enough of our patients, right?
Yes.
That the decision has been made that we universally screen.
Yes. And it's an endocrine disorder, which makes sense also with as many hormones as we're dealing with in pregnancy between the placenta and then just the patient herself, the own hormones that are going on, that it would make sense there was an effect on an endocrine issue. So what are some of the risks if someone develops diabetes during pregnancy?
Well, the one thing we can think of that is probably most detrimental is macrosomia.
Yeah.
And large, big babies.
Yeah.
And why is that? It's because they're essentially getting an IV line of maternal glucose through their umbilical.
Kind of like growth hormone, right? To the
right.
Yes, right. Exactly.
And so the unchecked gestational diabetes,
right,
are the ones that you're like, oh yeah, we've grown a 9 pound or 10 pound baby because of this unchecked increase in glucose.
Yeah. The other major risk during pregnancy is preeclampsia and hypertensive disorders. They kind of go along with each other. Gestational diabetes and hypertension are friends. They are in normal aging people. They are in pregnancy as well. Yeah. And then just the risk later in life of developing diabetes.
So let's start with when we just a regular risked person, a regular pregnant person in second trimester, when do we test?
Between typically 24 and 28 weeks. Many, many people think of it as kind of that classic 28-week lab.
Also, interestingly enough, when we talk about this, it's something to remember for students, the differences between screening tests and diagnostic tests.
Yes, absolutely.
So the thing we start with first is a screening test.
Yes.
So that screening test is a 50 gram load of glucose that we test the blood sugar at 1 hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so the screening test, now here's what's interesting. Depending on what body of literature you look at, the range for that first screening test can be between 130 and 140. All practices, look at 130 as their cutoff or 140.
Yes.
Now, if you use 130, you screen more people into needing a diagnostic test, but you really don't pick up that much more percentage of gestational diabetes with a cutoff of 130.
Right.
So 140 has always kind of been like our standard cutoff for whether or not a patient has been screened into needing a diagnostic test or screened out of needing a diagnostic test.
Right. And the original literature did say either 130 or 140, just how you said. It's become more common and is now talked about in some literature sources of using 135. I think people couldn't decide between the two. If you give people a choice, they don't know what to do with it. So they just averaged it. And so you will see 130, 135, or 140 used.
So when we, after that, let's just say our patient's glucose is 150 after their, 1 hour challenge.
That screening, yes.
We go on to a diagnostic test.
Yes. And for that, you give 100 gram load while they're fasting. And usually fasting is 8 hours. And then you draw the blood fasting, have them drink that 100 gram load, and then test at 1, 2, and 3 hours.
So I think for students who are listening to this, the way to remember this is the smaller dose, the 50 load, is only an hour. If you were doing a 2 hour test, you would add 25 and they'd get a 75 gram load. And for a diagnostic test, you add 25 more and you get 100 grams for a 3 hour test.
Right.
So here's where it gets a little tricky.
Yep.
What set of criteria do you follow? And I'll tell you that the two sets of criteria are really closely associated.
Yes.
And the Carpenter and Kustan criteria are a little tighter, right?
A little more conservative.
A little more conservative than the National Diabetes Data Group. But as a student, if you know generally each hour, then the criteria are going to be fairly closely linked.
Yes.
So I'm going to give you the Carpenter and Kustan first. They are fasting 95, 1 hour 180, 2 hour 155, and 3 hour 140. And so in order to be diagnosed with gestational diabetes, you have two abnormal values. Now, the National Diabetes Data Group also has their set of criteria, which are fasting of 105, 1 hour of 190, 2 hour of 165, and 3 hour of 145. So what you'll notice is in most of those cases, the number is within 10.
5 to 10, yeah.
5 to 10. So, at this point in my career, I can probably look at a 3 hour and be like, oh, she's diabetic based on whatever criteria, or any criteria, right?
Right.
If somebody's diabetic, they're going to fail on both sets of criteria.
Right, right.
So that's kind of what it comes down to. So what then? We'll get to that in a second. I want to talk for a second about early GTT.
Okay.
So there is a subset of people who we should screen earlier than 24 to 28 weeks.
Right.
Who are those people?
Well, so they are people that we're screening to see if they have type 2 diabetes generally. So did they come into the pregnancy with pre-existing diabetes? And in general, that would be someone that has a BMI that puts them into the overweight or obese class, plus one more risk factor.
And those risk factors are what?
So risk factors are first degree relatives that have diabetes, a high risk race or ethnicity, such as African American, Latino, Native American, Asian American, or Pacific Islander. Let's put a little asterisk next to that, because there are some people that don't think we should talk about race and ethnicity with risk, but that is typically published in all the lists. Any history of cardiovascular disease at all, anyone with hypertension, if they have an elevated cholesterol or triglyceride level, anyone with PCOS, if they are physically inactive or sedentary, and then any other condition that has been associated with insulin resistance. So that could be severe obesity, or if they have symptoms like acanthosis nigricans or something like that. That is if they have an overweight or obese BMI and any one of those things.
When do we do that test?
That test is typically done as early as you can in the pregnancy, but definitely before 24 weeks.
And then do you repeat it?
You would then test them. If they were not diabetic, you would then test them for the presence of gestational diabetes at the normal time. I should mention, there are other times that weren't in that list that I want to make sure we hit on too. So if they've had gestational diabetes in a previous pregnancy, if they have HIV, if they are 35 years of age or older, or if they have a hemoglobin A1C that was greater than 5.7%, or any other impaired glucose testing in the past, they should also have the early testing early in pregnancy.
So I think the take-home message to this is there are a lot of patients who really should be having an early GTT.
Looking for pre-existing or type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm. And we also repeat that.
Right, because we're looking for something different. Yeah. Right. Now, you mentioned, I just want to mention it here. It is not commonly done, but there is a different approach to diagnosing gestational diabetes with just a one-step approach. It is screening and diagnosis all in one test. And I have practiced in places where it's done this way, and I just want to mention it, although it is not supported by ACOG. So the American Diabetes Association and the International Association of Diabetes and Pregnancy Study Groups did recommend this one-step process, and it is with it's fasting. Come in, have the blood drawn fasting, take a 75 gram glucose load, and then test at 1 hour or 2 hours. If in my practice, we did fasting 1 hour and 2 hour, if any one value is abnormal, then they would have a diagnosis of gestational diabetes. I'm going to go over the values real quick. Fasting 92, 1 hour 180, or 2 hour of 153. There is just one set of values that is recognized. If one of those values is abnormal, then it's gestational diabetes. And so that it is interesting. There's some controversy around it, though, because you will definitely diagnose more people with diabetes with that test than you will with the traditional two-step method.
There is also a way that we can say somebody has overt type 2 diabetes. And so those criteria are a fasting glucose over 120, a random glucose over 200, mm-hmm. and a hemoglobin A1C of over 6.5.
Right.
And so in that case, we don't have to test somebody for gestational diabetes.
Right. They have type 2.
They have type 2. We just treat them.
Yes. I've also seen that if someone they're doing the traditional screening and then the follow-up, you know, 3 hour test, if abnormal, if their glucose was greater than 200 on just that, the initial screening, they have also gone ahead and diagnosed them with gestational diabetes and not done the 3 hour test. So sometimes there are ways that you could diagnose gestational diabetes without doing the full follow-up diagnostic test.
So side notes.
Yes.
To gestational diabetes, you will have patients who cannot tolerate drinking this Glucola situation, mm-hmm. which is essentially corn syrup in fizzy water.
Yeah. Some of it's colored, some of it's
mildly carbonated, really sweet water. And so when I talk to patients about this, like, hey, your next visit, we're going to do this, it tastes like really sweet soda, like really sweet Sprite,
but kind of flat.
Yes.
I mean, like only mildly fizzy.
Only mildly fizzy. So there are going to be patients who can't do that. So there are other ways that you can look at screening people. So there's a jelly bean situation.
Yes. From my understanding, it must be Brock's. It must be the regular size. And there is a certain number of them.
Them that you eat.
Yeah.
But there is on the web, there are lots of resources for how to get 50 grams or 100 grams.
There's certain types of diets that you can do. There's certain, I think even soda.
Orange juice. There's an orange juice situation.
Yeah.
It will tell you brands and how to do it. This is not something that we commonly recommend or see, but there are ways to do it.
It's just not as standardized. And it's really hard to say that you know the person got their 50 gram load at the right, in the right timing.
Yeah. And a more standard approach that practitioners are taking when patients can't do a 3 hour test is to have them do 3 times a day blood glucose monitoring for 2 weeks. And if their values are normal over 2 weeks, then we can with good confidence say that they don't have gestational diabetes.
Yeah. I've definitely seen that paneling done. Some might do it like fasting in the morning and then 2 hour postprandials for all 3 meals,
right.
Or 3 times a day, like you said.
The postprandial is the one that really matters.
Yes.
And the fasting, like if somebody wakes up and their fasting is, you know, 200, then they know that we know that their pancreas isn't doing what it's supposed to.
Right. Agreed. And so, you know, the main thing is that we diagnose the people that have gestational diabetes so that we can have intervention to avoid neonatal complications, to avoid additional pregnancy comorbidities, to really optimize the health for mom and baby both.
And remembering, like Kara said earlier, that gestational diabetes is a precursor for type 2 diabetes later in life.
It is. It is. You know, you mentioned that some people may not be able to tolerate it very well. I have in those situations, particularly in someone that came in and said, every time I've been pregnant, I throw up the Glucola or that sort of thing. I've written for Zofran for them before, and it works really well. Or that paneling is a really good idea.
Oh, we need to do an episode on how do we pre-medicate patients for things,
for different things?
I mean, like telling somebody to take ibuprofen before they're going to have their IUD put in, or giving them Cytotec before they're going to have their IUD put in, those kinds of things.
There are things that are helpful.
Side note. All right. So 7% of the people are going to have gestational diabetes.
Right. And it may depend on where you live and the health of the population that you take care of and the, you know, obesity levels and sedentary lifestyles. You may see more of this or you may see less.
Yeah. In my private practice that was kind of out in the middle of farmland, I saw a lot more gestational diabetes.
Yeah.
Because of sedentary lifestyle, because of I grew up on a farm, so I feel confident about like saying this, that like we don't eat the healthiest things.
I mean, I'm real happy with deep fried foods covered in gravy. So I resemble that remark.
And a lot of carbs.
Lots of carbs.
Lots of carbs. Like,
and dessert with every dinner.
Every dinner had dessert when I was growing up.
Oh man, now I'm hungry.
Every supper, I should say, had dessert when I was growing up. So yes. Because that's the difference, like when you live out in the Midwest. Dinner is lunch. Supper is the meal you eat in the evening.
I still say dinner for evening, but I do know many people that use that terminology.
Supper situation.
Yes.
So what happens next? What happens when our patients get that diagnostic?
So if they are diagnosed with diabetes, I will always put in a referral for diabetic education. So many, many patients can be managed with just lifestyle changes, non-insulin dependent gestational diabetes, not needing any medications. So our GDMA ones. And a lot of times it is just dietary choices and better understanding how they burn their glucose and use it during pregnancy, and then also changing physical activity.
Yeah. And we know physical activity in pregnancy has a lot of benefits, and this is just one of them.
And if you're waiting on that diabetic education, you can definitely get them a glucose monitor and strips so that they can start doing that 4 times a day testing. Again, being fasting in the morning, and then 2-hour postprandials are typically what I see done. And now I'm in a, you know, perinatology clinic, and that is what our typical testing is.
When we move on as midwives to patients who need more than just dietary counseling and they need meds or they need insulin, our scope of care really talks about at least co-management.
Yes, absolutely.
And so whoever that is in your setting, whether that's your supervising physician or whether that's MFM, what does that look like where you work?
Right, right. And typically, you know, we think of and understand that insulin is the gold standard in managing diabetes. But oftentimes we will try to avoid that because patients don't want to have to give themselves shots. They don't want to have to do that. It's not as appealing. And so oftentimes we might use some of our oral agents in pregnancy more frequently than we used to.
Yeah. And the oral agents don't come without side effects.
Right.
So that's something else to consider. Now, I work in a super high risk tertiary care center now. And, you know, when our diabetic patients come in labor, you know, we have a standard protocol for how, you know, we treat those patients. Mm-hmm. They get their blood sugars checked every 2 hours. Right. And if they have 2 abnormals, they trigger an insulin drip during labor.
Right.
So, that is something that is definitely managed by our physician team in the inpatient setting.
And for our diabetic patients, it may be additional antepartum surveillance, whether that's biophysical profiles or non-stress tests. It could potentially be an echo, particularly if they have pre-existing diabetes. And so you want to make sure that you're getting all of the appropriate testing and follow-up done if they do have a diagnosis of diabetes.
This is really, like, it's what's so crazy about how we care for patients during pregnancy is, like, this is just a tiny little like piece of what we do that has so many like components. And I think like things that affect pregnancy, like long range.
Right.
I mean, if you think about like all the things we have to be expert at to talk to our patients in the office, like at every pregnancy visit, there's something.
Right.
Right.
But you know how you mentioned 7%. I mean, there's a lot of things we prepare for in OB that are way less than 7%. And so that is a fair number of patients that are impacted.
And clearly we would not be doing universal screening for diabetes if it wasn't something that had some serious impact on pregnancy and birth.
Right.
So do you have anything else to add?
No, I think that, you know, like many other things, I have taken care of women over the years. And depending on the practice I was in, I had to risk them out of my care. Even in my first practice as a midwife, I could not care for the patients that were non-medication. Like they were lifestyle management. But because they had a diagnosis of gestational diabetes, I couldn't care for them anymore. And I oftentimes thought that's so silly because as a midwife, that was exactly the patients that needed me. They needed more education and counseling and support. And so the high-risk patients, if you can be involved in their care and you can help them with these different disease processes or pregnancy complications, it can really mean a lot to them. And helping them understand that they didn't do anything wrong. It's how their body and their hormones and so forth react to the pregnancy, and helping them understand that pregnancy is a state of insulin resistance and they didn't do this to themselves.
I also think when we talk about gestational diabetes and risking out, mm-hmm. if you are a midwife in an out of hospital practice,
yes.
or in an out of hospital situation, whether that's birth center, home birth, et cetera, like how you manage that is based on your own protocols. And whether or not what risk level opts them out of hospital care.
Yeah. And, you know, as someone that works at an MFM office now, and we get a lot of referrals from out of hospital birth providers, really taking the recommendations of the MFM and so forth, and them understanding your scope of practice, it can be such a good collaborative relationship. And, you know, making sure that we have the optimal place for delivery for care of not only the infant, but also of mom.
Agree with that completely. I was actually just talking to a midwife who is in an out of hospital practice, and we're talking about risking out with BMI.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a whole thing, right?
It's a bigger conversation now, but an important conversation for us to have, because not everyone is appropriate for out of hospital birth.
Some of this gestational diabetes conversation also links in with weight gain in pregnancy.
Yes.
And I know, you know, we have gotten away as midwives, and especially as midwives, of really talking about like the Institute of Medicine's, like when your normal weight, you should gain 25 to 35 pounds. But these are still things that they're in, like we see on board exams. Yes. And honestly, like our physician colleagues are still looking at this. You know, if you're overweight, you should only gain 15 to 20 pounds or 15 mm-hmm. to 25 pounds. And if you're obese or morbidly obese, 10 pounds.
Yeah. Like around, yeah.
Something low, very yes. low. And so your index of suspicion too, for things like diabetes, also comes with like extraordinary or excess weight gain in pregnancy.
Yeah. I used to get really angry when people would use the pregnancy BMI, in reporting risk, because I'm like, well, it really should be based on your pre-pregnancy risk, because that's, you know, kind of your preset risk scenario. But there is a fair amount in the literature more recently that it is exactly what you mentioned. Pregnancy BMI is important to compare to the pre-pregnancy BMI because of the amount of weight gain.
Yeah, this particular instance was about a patient whose pre-pregnancy BMI was in the 40s mm-hmm. and her 40-week BMI is in the 50s.
Yeah.
And so that 50 mark, 50 was like a mark where you had to like risk out of yeah. something. And I was like, wow, like it just seemed like, you know, you've been with a set of providers for a certain amount of time, and then all of a sudden you hit a certain number and you risk out. And I was just like, how can we avoid that? Mostly just because of continuity of care and how we're caring for our patients. But I mean, I think all of the conversation that we're having today about gestational diabetes and excess weight gain, like those are all, I think, important conversations to be having in pregnancy. And I think for even for somebody who doesn't need an early screen, talking about nutrition in those first trimester appointments is so important.
It is. And I also just want to reiterate, I think I've said this before, but as someone that did risk out of midwifery care in one of my pregnancies, that was when I needed that midwifery support more than any other time. And I'm just so thankful that I was still able to interact with and receive care and support from my midwives, in addition to my wonderful physician that took care of me. But it can be kind of traumatic for patients to lose out on that midwifery care, particularly when they sought that out for a reason.
I also am seeing more and more MFMs and fetal care centers employ midwives for exactly that.
Yes.
So here in Cincinnati at our children's hospital, they have some midwives that work with their fetal care center. And I find that to be fantastic because like you said, like I was a patient in one of those fetal care centers and I really needed a midwife to like walk me through what was happening with my baby.
Right.
And I think with MFM is the same way. Like there's some touch that comes with having midwifery care in collaboration with really smart people who are helping to manage you and your baby.
Yeah. So I hope this was a good review for everyone about the different types of screening and diagnosis and maybe just a brief scooch of management, but really hope this was helpful for everyone.
Yeah. And just to, again, cues for things that you need to understand and be able to talk about during the antepartum period.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for joining us today.
Have a great day.